I just don't like letting it become routine. If I can shrug it off, it's like pissing on their graves. Dom caught a glimpse of Marcus, Rojas, and Cole heaving crates into a small armored truck, probably feeling bored and guilty. They looked like another species of human alongside everyone else. Baird watched the spectacle, leaning against a fence. Calizo was watching Baird as if he was going to stroll across and deliver one of his weird philosophical pronouncements on life, death, and locust guts. That couple of seconds told Dom all he needed to know about his squad. But there was plenty he still didn't know about Bernie. How hard was it surviving on the road all that time? Or do I get the prize for the most dumbass question of the year? Hard, she said. Even for me. Even for a gear. In what way, exactly? Not knowing who else was out there? Not having comms? Realizing how fast humans turn into shithouses and rapists and vermin when there's nobody around to kick some civilization back into them? Bernie flexed her right hand a few times, as if testing it. But on the plus side, I ate a lot of interesting wildlife. You know why I'm asking. Your wife, yes? Yeah. He swallowed hard. She got really bad depression after our kids died. I mean bad. Weeks without speaking, eating. And then when I got back one day, she wasn't there anymore. The look on Bernie's face said it all for a fraction of a second. But she swallowed it like a pro and exuded solid confidence. Sergeants were universally good at making you feel you could do anything. Even Marcus could do that, even if he didn't do it with cheery reassurance.
Okay. I'll help you look for her, she said.
It was that simple.
You'll find her.
Even after 10 harrowing years, that lifted Dom's spirits like nothing else.
Thanks, he said.
Carlos really rated you. He was never wrong about people. Promise me you'll tell me those stories about him. Bernie nodded.
Yeah, course I will.
She didn't seem inclined to tell any right then. Lost for anything else to say, they helped out loading a truck. It was like cross-loading ammo. The sappers made sure every truck had a mix of supplies.
In case we lose some vehicles, one of the corporals explained. That way some of everything gets through.
Even Hoffman was getting stuck in, shifting sacks of grain. Cole nudged Dom as he passed. Colonels didn't do that stuff.
Shit. Can't ever accuse that guy sitting on his ass or being too grand to sweat a bit.
But he left Marcus to die. His orders. Leave him in the prison. Don't evacuate him. Dom was still waiting for Marcus to mention that. It was all going fine until Anya Stroud's voice suddenly boomed in his earpiece and made him jump.
Control to Delta. I've got visual coming in from Jack. There are drones on the surface heading in your direction. I have a Raven inbound to intercept.
Hoffman cut in.
Divert it here, Lieutenant. Pick us up and we'll engage them.
Yes, Colonel. 5 to 6 minutes. Stand by.
Hoffman seemed to come alive, like he suddenly remembered who he'd been at Asfo Point. It took years off him.
Rojas, you stay with the APCs. We'll need those mobile. The rest of you, with me.
His tone was almost kindly, by Hoffman's standards anyway. Dom's immediate thought was that he just didn't want an inexperienced kid with him. But then another thought crossed his mind. Maybe he thought the Rojas family had already lost enough sons. Shit. I'm still finding I don't know anybody like I thought. The man could be scrupulously fair. And that made his attitude to Marcus all the harder to fathom. King Raven, A-108, 2 kilometers east of North Gate.
Colonel, said the crew chief, leaning on the door gun. We can put you right on the ground, all part of the service.
Hoffman checked his rifle.
No need to expose yourself to unnecessary fire, Barber. Just stand by to extract us. Hoffman didn't get to use a Lancer half as often as he needed to. He knew that the gears were staring at him, probably thinking he was a sad old bastard trying to prove that he could still hack it like the younger guys. Maybe only Mataki actually understood what it was all about. A similar compulsion had brought her halfway across Sierra. When you know there was more life behind you than ahead of you, not the possibility of death in combat, but the imminent certainty of final decay, no deal to be struck with fate, things looked different.
"Sir, are you sure about this?"
The pilot Sorotky joined in. He obviously didn't want a dead colonel on his watch.
"Really?
What's the matter? Worried that humankind finally evolved something crazier than a raven jockey?"
Sorotky twisted in his seat as far as he could. The cabin was solid with gears, a tight fit for 7 men, even if one of them was a woman. Hoffman could just about see the crown of Sorotky's helmet.
"That's not biologically possible, sir,"
Sorotky said, and dipped the raven sharply below the roofline. He followed what had once been the line of the main road south to the coast, skimming the stumps of office blocks, and dropped to 5 meters to fly between the buildings for a while. It wasn't always easy to spot Locust from the air. Control was relying on Jack to recon the area and transmit back coordinates, but even that wasn't foolproof. The small bot could only cover so much ground. If it got too close, it was as much at risk as flesh and blood of attracting a stream of fire, and it was impossible to replace the machines now. Hoffman could remember a time when those flying buckets of bolts came by the crate load. Cog technology was now sliding backward in time.
"Colonel, you think we've seen the turning point?"
Barber asked.
"The Stranded seem to think so. They're like rats. They sense stuff long before we can. And we're not seeing grubs in anything like the numbers we're used to."
Hoffman longed to say something hopeful for a change, but couldn't.
"I've been asked that a lot in the last few days, and my answer's still the same. I don't know. I thought the Pendulum Wars would be over when we got the Hammer of Dawn technology, but it went on for another couple of years, and another God knows how many casualties."
30,000. Kalizo said quietly. He had his Lancer resting stock down on the deck, muzzle held two-handed, like an honor guard at a funeral.
30,510.
Nobody asked him why he could quote that number so easily, but Hoffman felt he should have known it too. He glanced around the crew cabin, wondering again what the hell was going on in Phoenix's head. It wasn't just that the man didn't say much. It was his eyes. They were unsettling, even predatory, but not angry. That was what baffled Hoffman. He was still expecting a knife in the ribs. If I'd spent 4 years in that shithole of a prison, and some bastard had left me locked there with hot and cold running grubs for company, I'd be looking to insert something sharp. Damn right I would. The court-martial in the House of Sovereigns had spent 2 days hearing how and why Phoenix had abandoned his post to help his father. Hoffman had sat through it all. Phoenix, a damn war hero, decorated with the highest honors, ignoring his orders and ultimately costing lives. Hoffman still didn't have an explanation. Reasons given were not the why he was looking for. Phoenix just looked away from him, not a trace of emotion visible, and seemed more interested in Kaliso's impressive but non-regulation lip piercings. Cole was studying them thoughtfully as well, with the frank gaze of a kid.
"Does all that metal shit make it hard to get women?"
Cole asked at last.
"I mean, no lady wants her mouth stapled shut, right?"
Everyone laughed, and Hoffman wished for a moment that he was still part of that camaraderie. It formed instantly. It held armies together a damn sight more effectively than any flag.
"Hey, Ty."
Bernie held out her hand, palm open.
"Let me borrow those things. I want to pin Baird's gob shut so we can all get some frigging peace."
Why ain't you got face tattoos, Bernie? Cole asked.
Different island.
She seemed to be looking at Santiago's right bicep. He had his wife's name tattooed there. Hoffman had never thought of immortalizing Margaret that way, and now he never would.
Different culture.
He wouldn't be able to read him through the wrinkles, Baird sneered.
And you won't be able to sit down for my boot up your arse, Blondie.
Contact dead ahead, visual, 500 meters, Soratki said. Group of grubs, maybe 10 or more, moving west toward us.
The locust would know they were coming, too.
Just set us down here and stand off, said Hoffman.
The raven couldn't land because of the uneven rubble filling the road, but Soratki held it a meter above the debris so the gears could jump clear.
You're crazy doing this, Phoenix muttered as he landed with a thud next to Hoffman.
Hoffman rapped his knuckles against his chest with a hollow thunk.
I've got plates, Sergeant.
I'd hate to have to do the paperwork if you didn't make it.
Phoenix probably meant exactly that. It wasn't code for caring. They formed an extended line to walk down the street, picking their way over fallen columns and shattered glass dulled by years of dirt. On a left turn from here, somewhere ahead, there was a military cemetery Hoffman didn't want to see the state that was in these days because he didn't need to hate the locust any more than he already did. It was hard to recognize the area, except for a few rusted wrought-iron balconies that had once been elegant and covered in flowering plants. Most hung at an angle by a single bar, threatening to fall. Only one still clung grimly to the remaining brickwork. Hoffman cupped his hand to one ear, the signal to freeze and listen. Rubble rattled and skidded as if being kicked ahead. The grubs couldn't tunnel here. They'd lost the element of surprise. He could still hear the low-level voice traffic in his earpiece.
Yeah, why am I doing this?
Because there was no aging gracefully in the New World Order. Whatever Prescott said, the definition of what was civilized had shifted. You were useful, or you were dead. Delta Squad melted into alcoves and dropped behind solid cover. Hoffman knelt on one knee beside Bernie. She kept putting a nervous finger on the chainsaw switch, as if she didn't trust it to work. Phoenix squatted on the other side of her, as if he didn't want Hoffman muscling in on his team.
"You haven't dropped a grub at close quarters before, have you?" Phoenix whispered to her.
"Anything under 600 meters is CQB for me."
"Trust me. Close is more satisfying."
Hoffman thought it was Phoenix's equivalent of reassuring banter for a moment, but the set of his jaw said otherwise. This wasn't normal soldiering. This was personal vengeance. Then the first three grubs came into view.
"Mine," said Phoenix.
But there were more than three. There were more than 10. There was a whole shitload of them. Almost on top of the squad now, just meters away. Hoffman counted at least 20. He sighted up from the cover of a shattered wall. And it felt good. He was scared and his heart was pounding, but he felt alive for the first time in ages.
"Let's ruin their day," he growled and opened fire.
The first five grubs went down like bricks, and then the rest were suddenly, instantly, overwhelmingly in Hoffman's path. Hideously distorted gray parodies of faces, freeze-framed in the bright light of muzzle flash, seeming silent in the deafening wall of noise. He emptied one clip and dropped back to reload as Baird poured fire from a doorway. Hoffman couldn't see Phoenix or Cole when he turned back again, but Caliso vaulted clear over a pile of rubble, firing as he landed, then brought his chainsaw down in a practiced arc as he cannoned into the locust drone. Both fell, Caliso on top, with his chainsaw embedded at an angle across the grub's sternum and its motor screaming. No, it was him making the noise, him screaming rage into the grub's face as he cut it apart. Bernie was halfway down the road now, moving from cover to cover, keeping up a solid wall of fire.
It couldn't have taken long. Part of Hoffman's brain somehow said the clips don't last that long, this is only seconds, but it was like a series of vivid, detailed images, unconnected as pictures in a gallery, light and noise and stench. By then, he was aware of running into the melee, aware of rounds rattling like hail on the walls, aware of the fact that he might have been hit, but feeling absolutely nothing. A grub dropped in front of him with its head gaping open, but he paused to use the bayonet anyway. Hoffman didn't have conscious control now. This was the familiar possession of primal hormones, still shocking and exhilarating and awful every time. His body said, "Leave it to me." He did. Suddenly a drone was right in front of him, and Phoenix was behind it. Phoenix just grabbed it around the neck and spun it around with him, using it to shield himself from fire. The impact of the round set him back a few steps, but he fired around the dying grub and took out its buddy, too. Cole, face and armor shiny with blood, not his, surely not his own, grabbed Phoenix's arm as the dead grub slid to the ground.
"We lost a couple of 'em," Cole yelled. "I hate leaving a job half done. Just gonna finish the paperwork."
Hoffman came to a halt. It felt as if the road and buildings were moving around him. Baird and Dom jogged around the rubble, kicking over grub bodies and firing bursts occasionally to make sure they were finished. Baird sounded personally offended.
"Die, you bastard," he kept saying. "I want to rust her out. Just friggin' well die."
Job done. It was only then that Hoffman glanced down and found his pants leg and boot were wet and peppered with holes. It pissed him off, not because of the pain, he'd feel it later back at the base, but because even a colonel had to jump through hoops these days to get new kit issued. He activated his radio to call the Raven, pausing to try to get his breath. Shit, he needed to be fitter than this. But suddenly he couldn't see Bernie.
"Where's Mataki?" he panted.
There couldn't be that many places to lose a goddamn gear in a deserted road like this.
"Where the hell is Mataki?"
Bernie could still see the locust drone ahead. The things could move fast when they felt like it, and this one was a champion sprinter over rubble. She stopped to fire again, but the Lancer stuttered to a halt and stopped spitting spent cases. By the time her hand went to the dump pouch on her pants leg, she knew she was out of ammo. And so was the grub. It stopped, looked back, and then came at her, retracing its steps.
"Come and have a go, then, tosser," she yelled, "and see how far you get."
Bernie had never used a chainsaw bayonet in anger. The drone came right at her, and she was still buoyed up on a wave of animal aggression and fear. "Me or you, you ugly bastard, and it ain't my time." She hit the power control, and the saw buzzed into life. The drone didn't stop. She stepped into its reach, one hand on the Lancer's grip, the other hand guiding the muzzle, and tried to dig the chain down into the grub's chest. It swatted at her with a massive arm and hit her in the mouth. For a second she was stunned to a standstill, but something completely instinctive boiled up from her gut and drove her blindly at the thing. She didn't have a male gear's weight, she didn't have the height either, but she was instantly and insanely enraged, and that made up for a lot. She rammed the saw into the easiest spot she could think of, to one side of the neck, and down through the collarbone into the chest, sending debris flying. The damn locust seemed to keep flailing its arms forever. The debris coming at her was dark, metallic. Then it changed color. The grub's arm dropped to its side. A shockingly strong spurt of blood hit her full in the face, hot and oddly sharp, like a spray of needles. The saw skipped and screamed as if it had hit metal, kicking her back. But she didn't dare stop. She couldn't. She didn't want to. She wanted annihilation, destruction, the end to this animal roar that was venting out of her. She couldn't see anything now except the drone's gaping mouths, and then it sank to its knees and hit the ground.
Bernie!
Someone yelled. Cole. It was Cole.
Bernie! Grub on your six!
She turned, trying to pull the chainsaw out of the locust, but all she could do was draw her sidearm left-handed to realize she was out of ammo with that, too. Then Cole vaulted from nowhere, like he'd jumped clean over a wall and opened fire. Blood plumed from the grub's chest as it fell, firing. It was all over. For the first time, Bernie could hear herself, the of labored breath.
Shit,
she said. She couldn't think of anything else to do except try to free her bayonet. She still had the Lancer's grip in her right hand.
Shit, what is this?
She spat to clear her mouth. Her chin felt wet. It was only when she holstered her pistol and wiped her free hand over her face that she felt the shards of something hard and sharp.
"Bernie, you're learning to cook," Cole said approvingly. "That ain't your blood, by the way."
No, it wasn't. She could smell that. Something pricked her finger like a splinter.
"This is fucking bone!"
"Yeah, they do that when you slice 'em."
Cole fumbled in his belt for something and pulled out a grubby rag. He went to wipe her face, as if he was dealing with a kid's snotty nose, then paused and handed her the cloth.
"Be careful you don't get bone in your eye. Ain't fun, believe me. See the doc when we get back."
"Shit, I don't usually get sprayed by my kills."
She felt suddenly elated that she'd instinctively got it right. She knew where to place a cut for the quickest kill, even in one of these utterly inhuman creatures. Down through the big arteries, through the chest cavity, through the thoracic triangle.
"I'd forgotten the personal touch."
Bernie rocked the Lancer back and forth with her boot on the creature's chest until the chainsaw came loose with a sudden jerk. She should have realized what a mess it would make. You couldn't put a high-speed chainsaw through metal, flesh, and bone and not expect some flying object damage. Goggles. Now she understood why most gears wore goggles.
"No bastard told me that. Thanks, Marcus."
But the thing that really shocked her was that she wanted to do it again. She wanted to carve every last grub on the planet, all of them, right now. It shocked her because her job was taking a calm, passionless shot at long distance. Nothing personal, just doing the business after a long and patient wait. One shot, one kill. This was something entirely different, against an enemy that was much harder to drop than a human. She had trouble slowing her breathing and calming down again.
"Thanks for watching me back, Cole."
She patted his massive, sinewy forearm. He was simply the biggest human being she'd ever seen. Maybe that was why he could afford to be such an easygoing lad. For most people, his bulk would have been intimidating. But she simply felt as if she was in the welcome shelter of a huge, amiable oak tree, with a rifle.
"This is seriously hard work, this chainsaw business."
"We got to get some weight on you, lady. You need mass. Don't worry about how big your ass gets. You need mass to lean into this thing."
He demonstrated the optimum position with his Lancer.
"I am personally going to see your diet improves. No more snacking on cats and rats. Ain't enough calories."
"There's 30 calories in a mouse,"
Bernie said, adrenaline ebbing at last. She could hear the chaka-chaka-chaka of the King Raven heading back, but movement caught her eye, and she turned to see Marcus.
"What the hell has he got now?"
Marcus jogged up to them with some unidentifiable pieces of circuit board half-sheathed in metal casing. There was also a severed locust hand jammed in it.
"Asshole wouldn't hand it over,"
Marcus said, holding his Lancer away from his side. It looked like he'd minced steak with it.
"I don't even know what it is. But Baird can play with it."
"Is everyone okay?"
"Not if you include grubs. And Hoffman's got a big chunk out of his calf that's going to need fixing."
Bernie listened for some satisfaction in his voice, but there was none. She still couldn't gauge how he really felt about Hoffman now. The King Raven threw a shadow over them and sent dust and grit whirling as it set down 20 meters away. The squad came running around the corner, except Hoffman, who was limping along with Dom's support and cursing to himself. Corporal Barber leaned out the door, one hand gripping a tether and his other arm outstretched to them. Even when she didn't need extracting in a hurry, Bernie always felt that same flood of relief when she saw the crew chief. The Raven's door was an instant portal to safety from a killing, burning, screaming world. It was home. Dom gave Hoffman a leg up into the Raven. "You old folks," he said to Bernie, grinning, "always gotta prove how damn tough you are." The flight back to North Gate was that giggling, shaky aftermath of a close brush with oblivion. One nudge could have tipped the mood over into something darker. Dom squeezed into the seat next to Bernie, almost crushed by Cole on the other side.
"Come on, Mataki," Dom said. "Tell me all about my brother."
"I will," she said, dodging the inevitable again. She caught Marcus's eye. He turned his head away, resigned, grim, and the mention of Carlos obviously still hurt somewhere.
"I'll tell you anything you need to know, and you need to know that some of it might upset you."
It was her bargain with herself as much as with Marcus. How much did any brother need to know?
"I realize that," Dom said.
Bernie doubted it. He had no idea what she had to tell him. Chapter 9. Infantry, armor, artillery. We're all about guns, bigger guns, ships to carry even bigger guns, and aviation to support those guns and the gears carrying them. We've never moved much beyond the model of the primacy of land forces. We've grown comfortable with the war. The time's coming when we'll need to work smarter, to develop aviation and maritime assets in their own right, and maybe even move onto the turf the intelligence community guards so jealously. We've got to be more flexible to be ready for whatever the future might throw at us, because the next enemy may not think like us. Professor Adam Phoenix, addressing defense procurement executives at a seminar at La Croix University. Marinat Naval Base Training Area, northeast coast of Tyrus, 2 years, 3 months before E-Day, 16 years ago. Carlos judged the depth of the water wrong. He stepped off the ramp of the landing craft, expecting to sink a few inches. Then there was absolutely nothing under his boots, and he fell. It only took a fraction of a second to lose orientation in the dark. The water wasn't that deep. He was almost on the beach. He'd seen the drifts of wet pebbles along the shoreline glinting red and green from the landing craft navigation lights. And still he ended up pitching forward and going under, inhaling shockingly cold seawater, desperately thrashing around with one hand for something solid to push against while he struggled not to drop his rifle. This wasn't like the swimming pool. It was filthy, pitch-black water, swirling with weed and mud churned up by ships. His pack was so heavy that he couldn't get up. He was going to die. An experienced gear dying on a fucking exercise, and somehow the shame of that was uppermost in his mind as he started to drown.
"I gotcha, Carlos, I gotcha, okay, I gotcha."
The voice was distant. Then something caught the rear neck section of his armor, and his head lifted clear of the water. Carlos realized it was four fingers hooked firmly under the rim, lifting him back to life. He inhaled a wheezing, desperate breath that didn't seem to suck in any air at all. Marcus half-dragged, half-lifted him upright. He choked and coughed, legs moving automatically until his feet found solid ground. He managed a few more steps, crunching into shifting shingle. Gears ran past him,
seeming in slow motion as they struggled against the bank of pebbles. It felt like the worst vomiting Carlos could imagine. He coughed and retched until he thought his guts were going to burst out through his nose.
"Phoenix! Phoenix! Did I tell you to damn well stop and have a damn picnic? Did I?"
It was Major Stroud. She had a cut-glass, posh accent that sometimes just didn't go with her colorful language. Carlos managed to straighten up, eyes streaming, just as she reached him and shoved him hard in the shoulder.
"Santiago, you'd be lying dead on this goddamn beach with 100 frigging rounds in you. Shift it before I put my boot up it."
In daylight, Stroud was a good-looking woman for her age, blessed with a wide smile and that luminous kind of skin that hyper-fit people always had. Now her features were blurred with dark camo, and she wasn't pretty at all. She was soaking wet from the waist down, and as angry ugly as any hairy-assed sergeant. It was shaming. He wasn't some new recruit, and he wasn't her awestruck little daughter, either. He decided he'd rather die than fall behind and look like a complete asshole in front of Marcus. That bothered him more than Stroud yelling about what a dick he was. Marcus kept pace with him up the shingle bank until they reached the laying-up position behind it and dropped prone to check their rifles. Carlos heard the click-clack of rifle catches in the darkness and spat salt water into the muddy sand.
"You okay?" Marcus asked.
"Yeah, thanks."
Carlos reached for his night vision goggles. He tested the earpiece, surprised that it still worked.
Shit, it was only waist-deep. Knee-deep, even.
"Hey, it's the first time we've done this at night. You probably hit a hole or a rock or something. We'll all be fine on the day."
"Okay, move out,"
Stroud yelled. Fine on the day. What day? Carlos got to his feet and sprinted for the next cover and the next, following a zigzag course across short, tufted grass to a knot of small trees beyond. He was on solid ground now, the kind of terrain he understood. What day? They'd been told nothing except that it was an amphibious insertion and that they would have to take and hold an area for an unspecified period. What day? Whatever it was, Dom was involved, too. Carlos hadn't seen him since he was recalled from leave, and his calls and letters were completely devoid of any clue about what he was doing. That wasn't like Dom at all. It didn't take a rocket scientist to work out that this was something big, even if the numbers involved didn't appear to be significant. But would we know? No. We just know what we're doing, our small chunk of the op. We won't know where we fit in with the bigger picture until the last minute. He hated that. Okay, there was always need to know, but a bigger picture always helped focus him better. Didn't they trust Gears by now? Carlos moved through the trees and into open ground, expecting enemy contact. It came in a sudden flurry of dummy pyrotechnics and smoke bombs that recreated a minefield. Carlos was still coughing up water, or at least he felt he was. Marcus slowed to whack him hard between the shoulder blades a few more times.
"Okay, fall out and see the medic," he said. "You don't sound too good."
"I was only underwater for seconds."
"You damn well do it, or I'm not having you in this squad."
"Marcus, I only inhaled some frigging seawater."
"Secondary drowning. Read the safety manual. I'm not taking you home in a body bag."
"Yes, Mom."
"I mean it. Fall out."
Marcus had his serious, "I'm your corporal" voice on. He called for a medic on the radio.
"You must have got a lung full."
"Yeah. I didn't exactly lose a leg."
Stroud came on the radio.
"Santiago, you heard the man. Now!"
Carlos was furious. The medic actually came and got him, which was even worse, but at least they let him walk off under his own steam. He knew he should have been grateful that Marcus had saved him, but all he felt right then was humiliated and useless.
He kept turning to see the flash grenades and smoke bombs as the exercise developed into a full-scale firefight in the wooded area beyond the shore. In the medical tent, he submitted to the doctor's examination with bad grace.
"This is frigging dumb," he said.
"Sir."
"Yeah, you really should have had your ass shot off," the lieutenant muttered, percussing his back. "Go try again, and don't come back until you're properly maimed."
"I didn't stop for shrapnel in my face on a real op, so..."
"Heard it all before. Shut up while I'm listening to your lungs."
Carlos got the full lecture about deaths within 20 seconds of immersion, secondary drowning after aspiration of 15 cc's of water, and a whole raft of shit that was probably supposed to make him feel better about himself and less angry at Marcus.
"If you're not dead in 4 hours," the lieutenant said briskly, "you're in the clear. Stay on that gurney and call for aid if you get any chest pain or shortness of breath."
Carlos found it funny that he was almost casavacked for falling in a meter of water, but that the cog was fine with him having live rounds part his hair. He spent 2 miserable hours, he counted, staring at the roof of the tent and listening to the distant battle. By the time it was over, the sun was coming up, and the medic relented and pronounced Carlos not dead, so that he could get to the RV point for the wash-up. It was 100 meters from the dockyard accommodation blocks. Carlos caught a seductive whiff of breakfasts frying behind the wire fence. Marcus wandered over to him, rubbing his nose on the back of his hand, eyes bloodshot with smoke and lack of sleep.
"It's just an exercise," he said, shoulders braced as if he was expecting an argument.
"I could have carried on. You know I could."
"Yeah. I just didn't think it was worth the risk of losing you for the real op."
That was pragmatic and true. But Carlos knew Marcus was like one of those Islander poems that sounded as if they meant one thing but could be read another way entirely. Carlos's close call had shaken him. Marcus never worried about his own ass. He only worried about what happened to Carlos and Dom. And it worked both ways. There was a shitload of meaning in the word friend.
"Yeah, you need a Santiago there or it's not a real battle," Carlos said.
The fragrant Navy breakfast continued to tantalize at a distance, unreachable and forbidden. The gears weren't allowed to hang out with the fish heads. They gathered in the cover of the woods and dug self-heating rations out of their packs. Whatever they were training for, it was obviously not for discussion, even with other services. Carlos rejoined the company, feeling like a fraud. Mataki squatted down, heels flat, then shook her ration pouch to mix the contents.
"What do you got, Sarge?" Kaliso asked.
"Chili dysentery," she said. "You?"
"I think it's curried diarrhea."
"Swap?"
The two islanders exchanged rations. Marcus didn't even look at the label on his and tucked in. Carlos wondered what old man Phoenix would think of his boy now, eating shit rations with a bunch of grunts, talking like he'd come from the dog-rough end of town and not from serious money, and visibly, utterly content. Marcus was one of life's doers. Just because he was smart didn't mean he would have enjoyed spending his life in a laboratory. Carlos understood that from the first time he'd seen him throw a punch. That memory still surfaced occasionally, and it reminded him that there was a desperate fighter inside Marcus that didn't do anything by halves.
"You'd think they could put the bloody ramps down on the dry bit," Mataki said, poking her fork into the foil pouch. "I just hate water. Water should come out of a shower or a glass. Rivers, fine. Bigger than rivers? Saw that for a lark."
Carlos took it as a bit of sympathy.
"I thought you came from the islands."
"Exactly," she said. "The dry bits, not the wet bits. I'd rather parachute in, thanks."
The wash-up was conducted where they sat, huddled among the trees while an icy rain bordering on sleet started to fall.
Stroud had brought her daughter with her, presumably to toughen her up after all that fancy accelerated training at the academy. There was another young cadet trailing her, too, but Carlos didn't know who he was. Not family, that was for sure. Stroud gave no indication that Anya Stroud was her kid from the way she treated her. Not hostile or gruff, just distant and professional. It reminded Carlos of the way Marcus's dad behaved. But Stroud was no cold fish like the professor. She filled any room she entered, and it was impossible not to want to charge after her into a melee with complete confidence. She oozed winner. Her daughter only oozed competence. Carlos felt sorry for her, a scale model of her mother, pale and smaller. But that was what happened to seedlings that grew in the shadow of a much bigger tree. She didn't even seem to know she was beautiful. That was how far her mother towered over her. Other good-looking women always seemed to have that "I'm nature's gift to men" kind of confidence, but not Anya.
"I've always said we should take amphibious ops more seriously," Stroud boomed.
Carlos was sure some of the guys were holding their breath.
"It's never been part of Cog doctrine. Sierra's a world of contiguous landmasses, so it's always been all about moving gears over land and using maritime elements for aviation and gunfire support. Well, that oversight is finally going to work in our favor. The Indies won't be expecting us to insert from the coast."
Coast? Well, that was obvious. They'd been training to deploy in landing craft, and there was plenty of coast on Sierra. It didn't tell Carlos anything he didn't know already.
"Ma'am?"
Marcus raised his hand. He'd switched back to his old voice. Posh Marcus, son of a dynasty.
"Are we allowed to ask operational questions?"
"No, but you'll ask anyway, Phoenix."
"What's the objective beyond establishing a beachhead? Is this an invasion?"
"You don't need to know that," she said quietly. "And I'm not sure now if I'd even have an answer."
The posh Marcus voice seemed to get more results. Maybe it said to Stroud that she was talking to one of her own class, someone who knew which fork to use at the regimental dinner. But Carlos still knew shit about the operation. No, he knew less. They transferred back to camp by bus. Apart from the brief forays onto landing craft, how to board the things, how to debark, how not to drown yourself, the gear's contact with the Navy had been kept to a minimum. The brass definitely didn't want to draw attention to special maritime training. There were, of course, UIR intelligence agents operating everywhere, or at least the COG told them to assume there were. Walls have ears. It made sense. Everything the COG said usually did. Carlos could hear Stroud holding court at the front of the bus. No fancy staff car home for her, no sir. She was lecturing her two visibly terrified cadets on the virtue of getting out of CIC and seeing what the gear on the ground had to endure before daring to deploy men. Ah, so that was the point of all this. It was meet the noble gear time for the kids in dispatch.
"She's a psycho," Marcus whispered.
Carlos caught Anya's eye for a moment as her fix on her mother's face wavered, and it said, "I am not worthy." But her gaze came to rest on Marcus for the time it was allowed to escape, and not on Carlos. He felt crushed and guilty at the same time.
"Well, shit. What did I expect? What would she see in me?"
"We need a psycho," Carlos said, comforting himself with the thought that an impossible date with Anya Stroud would only mean savage scrutiny from her mother, and fraternizing would end a couple of careers. She was a prize for the likes of Marcus, not him. "A psycho who wins." He had to call Dom as soon as he got the chance. Maria was due soon. She was going to be mad if Dom was away for the birth, or at least she said she was. So Carlos read that as being scared instead. She was 17 with a second child on the way, Dom was 18 in a few weeks. That sounded scary enough to Carlos when he added the fact that Dom was now, much as he despised the phrase, on a secret mission. But the Santiagos were lucky. Nothing would happen to Dom, and if it did... No. Carlos wasn't even going to think it. Briefing Room, House of the Sovereigns, Ephira.
I hear good things about your boy, Professor.
Hoffman held out his hand to Adam Phoenix. He didn't look much like his son, except for those mad dog eyes. That was what they reminded him of, it hit Hoffman at last. It was those black and white guard dogs with the manic blue eyes, all ferocious intelligence, but likely to take your balls off if you turned your back on them.
Natural-born gear.
Phoenix shook his hand with an impressively strong grip.
Thank you. Marcus makes a success of anything he turns his mind to.
Most fathers said they were proud, every time, always that, proud. But Phoenix seemed to measure his words with a micrometer.
You wanted your boy to be an officer, didn't you?
Hoffman nodded politely.
Yes, he does. You know the Santiago brothers, too, don't you? Dominic's in one of my squads. Smart, gutsy boy. Steady under fire.
They've been very close to Marcus since they were children. So, Professor Phoenix was a man who restated known facts in lieu of a conversation. Okay. He was steeped in secrecy as part of his job. So was Hoffman. But if Hoffman had had a son, he'd have said something about him straight from the gut, he knew. Maybe Phoenix saved it for Stroud. She was the one with his son's life at her personal disposal.
I assume your son isn't aware you're working on the Hammer Project, Hoffman said.
Of course not. It's on a need-to-know basis.
That was the point at which Hoffman decided he didn't like Adam Phoenix. It never took him long to make up his mind. Agent Satil slipped into the meeting room with a folder under her arm and began pinning sheets from it on the display board on the wall. The number of people in these meetings had dropped drastically. Now it was down to Satil, General Ivor, Hoffman, Michelson, and the recent addition of Phoenix. Whatever went on in other meetings connected to Op Leveler, Hoffman had no idea. This was purely about Asfo Point itself, the job the raiding party had to do.
I just hope some bastard has a good overview.
General Ivor walked in and indicated the aerial photographs on the wall, now building up into a bigger picture of the eastern Austrian coastal plain and taking in a couple of towns.
Change of plan, he said. Look.
The satellite images still showed a largely uninhabited area dotted with the remains of long-abandoned farmhouses and three military targets, Asfo Point itself, and two UIR army camps, both about the size that suggested single company strength, nothing more. But there were also clusters of dots scattered along the roads, army vehicles, at the entrance to the largest channel forming the estuary.
"Want me to interpret this for you in a timeline context?"
Satil asked.
"We've monitored activity at intervals over the last couple of years, and this level isn't normal. Basically, they're reinforcing north of Asfo Point, and the two most likely reasons they do that is that they're stepping up operations there, so they have something even more significant to defend, or they know we're coming."
There was a long pause. Hoffman could only see months of intense preparation vanishing. Michelson got up and wandered across to the board to examine the images more closely.
"How the hell would that leak?" Hoffman said. "The whole op has been compartmentalized. We've isolated the training as far as we can without making it totally damn useless. We've shaved the numbers of personnel involved to the bone. We've not procured special equipment. This op is as closed as it's possible to make it."
Ivor shrugged.
It's possible the Indies have finally realized how vulnerable the facility might be, and they're close to making Hammer operational. The line between advertising that you have a high-value target and protecting it adequately is a fine one.
The most direct route to Asfo Point was heading south along the coast, past the port of Barifus, and into the estuary. A steep shelf offshore meant the water was deep enough to drop two small raiding craft close in with minimal exposure. The other routes meant shallow water and a longer infiltration, time during which the raiding party would be very exposed.
"So how are we going to play this now?" Michelson asked. "We can't reassure them that we haven't noticed Asfo so they can relax, can we? So we adapt. We've still got to prevent their using that technology at the very least. But seizing it now might be a tall order. What exactly are we trying to lay hands on? Data? Hardware? Scientists?"
Satil sifted through another pile of papers and handed a sheaf to Phoenix. "That's the latest technical assessment we have. Apologies for the gaps. It's being gleaned from phone taps, and that's patchy at best." Phoenix was the only man in the room, and possibly the only man in the cog who stood a chance of understanding whatever was on that paper. Hoffman still felt uncomfortable and would have preferred to see it. He watched Phoenix reading, mad dog eyes darting from side to side as he scanned each paragraph, and Hoffman wondered how the man would reach a judgment on what needed doing. Phoenix would have to put it in plain language that a troop of commandos could understand and interpret. They needed to know exactly what they were looking for. They weren't scientists. They'd have just their common sense to guide them in a big hurry and under fire.
"Make it achievable, Professor," Hoffman said. "If we guess at this, we might as well simply line up the Navy and get them to sink the whole coast."
Phoenix didn't look up. Even Ivor waited for him. The entire intelligence operation and the military were simply the errand boys now, hanging on a shopping list from the technical experts. "He's probably known about this since Intel started monitoring it. Why does that thought piss me off so much?"
"Make sure you pack a few bots, then," Phoenix said at last. "Because you're going to need to strip the Asfo mainframe, as well as hoping they don't have all this backed up off-site. If they're that paranoid, they might not have, because that doubles their security problem. Once you've done that, if you can do that, then destroy the site."
"I thought you needed live boffins," Michelson said.
It was his word for scientists. But Hoffman had never worked out if it was affectionate or dismissive.
"If you don't, then it removes one problem for the Major. He doesn't have to worry about extracting civilians."
Phoenix's jaw worked for a few moments. He seemed to be staring at the papers without reading. His eye movement had stopped.
"Are you asking me as a human being, as a scientist, or as a soldier?" he said at last.
Satil saved Michelson the problem of answering. "We're asking you as a loyal citizen who doesn't want to see the UIR able to target any COG state from orbit. Because if you don't need the personnel along with their data, they come under the heading of asset denial."
"Shoot them, you mean," Phoenix said.
"Could they reconstruct the satellite program from scratch?"
"It's not like a list of numbers you can memorize."
Phoenix was definitely uncomfortable with the idea. His pauses and blinking gave him away.
"But nobody forgets their methodology, and so, given a little time, they could recover the program, yes."
"That's all we need to know. Thank you."
"They're civilians, Agent Satil."
She gave him a completely cold smile, the mere exposure of teeth. "They're building a weapon of mass destruction, Professor Phoenix." Ivor didn't offer an opinion, and neither did Michelson. They looked at Hoffman.
"Are you asking me to add assassination to the task list?" Hoffman asked.
"I'll need to run that past Chairman Dalyell, Major."
Ivor had never been a squeamish commander, as far as Hoffman knew, but he had political ambitions, and he probably didn't want a decision like that lurking in his file to be used against him at the most inconvenient time, as such things usually were. It'll require his explicit authorization. Hoffman rarely needed reminding why he would never reach the highest ranks. He simply didn't think like Ivor and his ilk. His first fear wasn't what issuing an order to assassinate civvies would do to his career, but what not removing them would do to his world and everyone else's. "We'd be killing civilians," Phoenix said again. "Presumably unarmed civilians at that."
"Maybe you blinked and missed it, Professor," Hoffman said. "But these unarmed civilians are building the biggest fucking gun on the planet."
Ivor cut in. "Gentlemen."
"Okay, maybe it's because they've got qualifications and white coats, not uniforms."
Hoffman stopped short of asking what Phoenix would have done if he'd still been a gear.
"Does it make you feel uncomfortable because they're doing what you do? Because I'd have thought you'd dealt with the shoot or be shot thing when you were a serving officer."
"It's wrong," Phoenix said quietly. "It's simply wrong."
"Why? You think they don't know that what they're building kills people? Where's their responsibility in this?"
"If this is an exercise in logic, Major, you've won. But I still don't like the idea of executing civilians for having dangerous knowledge."
"That's all right," Satil said sweetly. "We'll kill the intelligentsia. You just concentrate on developing things that kill soldiers and the uneducated."
Hoffman almost didn't believe he'd heard her say it. Ivor shuffled uncomfortably, but he didn't seem willing to dare to rap her over the knuckles. It wasn't just because she was a spook. She was remarkably intimidating in a way that Hoffman completely admired. She didn't give a damn about being liked or promoted as long as the job got done. That was his kind of colleague. Good girl. Phoenix just smiled back, unflappable, on the outside at least.
"I'll do that, Agent Satil," he said.
Ivor diffused the situation as best he could by getting up and slapping the back of his hand against the panorama of overlapping images.
"I do appreciate this is getting to be intolerable pressure for everyone. So, our approach now will be to identify an alternative route as quickly as possible. If they think we're interested in the Barifus dockyard, let's oblige them," said Michelson. "Set it up so they think we're aiming at a backdoor invasion of Pell's. Heavy-handed recon of the appropriate route, mutterings about Pell's vast emulsion stockpiles, increased naval activity in the north of Asfo. That puts a lot of their troops in the area when we want to stroll in," Hoffman said.
"But they won't be keeping such a close eye on Asfo Point, will they?"
"Not unless they think we're aware of its importance."
"We can test that," Satil said. "And misinformation is no problem. But it's going to cost a little to make it look as if we're preparing for an invasion. A credible build-up, at least for the benefit of their reconnaissance."
Hoffman studied the map. It didn't leave him much choice. It was flat ground, and the assault team needed to spend as little time on it as possible, which meant picking a long route through channels shrouded in reed and grass.
"We'll have to insert from the south, through the salt marsh. Minimum is still three teams, one to overcome the security measures, one to do the rummage, and the other to neutralize the personnel and lay the charges. We can still do this at night, I assume?"
"The staff still live at the site during the working week," Satil said. "We time this for a weekday evening, same as the first plan."
"And we have to transport bots. That's going to put a lot more strain on the men. You've got a troop of Pisang Hill men drawn from the Allied forces, and special duties gears from 2-6 RTI, Ivor said. "They're supposed to be the COG's finest."
Hoffman raised an eyebrow.
"They've still only got two arms, two legs, and one ass each, General."
Indeed. And once they're ready to go in, C Company 26RTI, under Major Stroud, will isolate the ASFO site and hold back any unwelcome attention from the land side.
Hoffman wondered how Phoenix felt listening to this. His son was in C Company. Marcus Phoenix wouldn't even know where he was going to be deployed.